Okay, so the main topic for this week is what Adassa talked about at the end of last week's shiur, which is the problem of Yaakov stealing the bracha and how that spills over into how we look at his whole story and all of the deceptions that are involved in Yaakov's life. So that's where that's the main shiur. If there's time, and you know, since we got to 10:40, I think we're not starting. I don't know that we will. But I saw this very strange tshuva from Rav Asher Weiss this week that I just couldn't resist. That in the event that we have time, we'll do it on the question of Laban says to Yaakov, "You're not allowed to marry the younger before the older." How do we paskin on that issue? What's actually the halacha? Like, is there any rule requiring that the they're all given out? They should be here somewhere. Is there any? If we have time for that, then we'll get to that also. Are you allowed to marry off the younger before the older? So that's in other words, you pass them like Yaakov or Lava. So it's a fascinating thing in its own right. Maybe we'll get to that. Maybe we won't. We'll see. But I have sheets for that as well if we get that far. Okay, so going back again to that question of the theft of the bracha and how in the world we're supposed to talk to our kids about it, how we're supposed to think about it ourselves. So I brought you on the sheet in sources 1, 2, 4, and 5. The basic problem here, and it's Yaakov's series of deceptions. So we start by looking at his first deceptions with Esav. So the beginning of it isn't really deception, and that's something that we have to really refine in terms of the word that we use. But take a look at number one. This is when Esav comes in from the field and Yaakov has his lentil stew. Vayomer Esav al Yaakov. Esav says to Yaakov, Hal itaini namin ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. He says, feed me from this red stuff. Ki ayef anochi, because I am really tired. Alkein karashimo Edom, and therefore he gets the name Edom. Fine. Vayomer Yaakov, and Yaakov says back to him, oh, you're really tired. Mechrach hayom es bechoras chali. Sell me your bechora. Sell me your birthright, and then, sure, you can have some soup. And Esav's response is, I'm dying here. Literally, he says, hinei anochi olech lamus, v'lamazali bechora. What do I care about the bechora? That is number one, in terms of his involvement with Esav, demanding that Esav sell him something of incredible value, right? His bechora. Bechora meaning double portion as the bechor, so that he can just give him a little bit of soup. That's number one. And then number two, of course, is the swapping of the bracha, separate from the bechora, where we don't confuse the two. The bechora is his birthright as the oldest. The bracha is Yitzchak conveying to him what he received from Avraham, and it's all of the plenty that is bestowed, in fact, on Yaakov. And we find him play this trick in which he dresses up, he plays with his language, right? Rashi makes the point, I'm sure you've heard it in Divrei Torah or learned it on the Parsha. I gave you one example here in still in number one. Vayomer ata zeh bini Esav. Right, Yitzchak says to him, Yitzchak can't see, he says, Ata zeh bini Esav, you're my son Esav, and he responds, Ani, me, right, which Rashi makes the point, he didn't say, I'm Esav, right. Now, some of those reads into the Pesukim are a little disingenuous. So, for example, when he first walks in, he says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. So they make the point of saying, well, you know, he's saying, Anochi, it's me. Esav is your firstborn. The problem is that when Esav comes in, he uses the same words. He also says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. If you're really going to tell me that that he's changing his wording in order to avoid that, it doesn't really seem to carry through so well. But this is your first set of games that Yaakov is playing, and even Yaakov's refusal to play the game. Right? When Rivka first says to him, I heard your father talking to Esav, and now this is what you should do, on what grounds does he refuse initially? What's his response to his mother? Yeah, I'm going to get caught. His response is not, how could you suggest such a thing? I love truth. I could never trick my father. I could never cheat my brother. No, it's like, what if I get caught? It doesn't sound like a very principled response. So that's set of deceptions, and not only deceptions, but what seems like impropriety, number one, demanding from Esav that he give him the bechora, and then tricking Yitzchak in order to get the bracha.
Yeah.
So that's the big question, is what does Rivka mean when she says, Alai kilalascha b'ni, that it's on me, the curse is on me. So there are different ways that line is explained. The simple read of the pasuk is she's saying, if there's any punishment that's going to come, it should be on me. It's not a nevuah, it's almost a tefillah. It's saying, Hashem, let me suffer for whatever it is. Then there are other layers to it. I think I mentioned once the idea that Alai kilalascha b'ni is her saying, Hashem put me in this position to make this decision. I know that this is really what's right, which follows through Rivka's general approach since the day when they asked her to marry Yitzchak, back when she was still living in the house of Bethuel. Another way to take it is that it's this odd nevuah, which I think Rashi even mentions there, that actually you are going to have to pay for this, Yaakov. And that Alai is read as an acronym. Right? You've heard that. Alai is an acronym. Ayin Lamed Yud is Esav, Lavan, Yosef. Your curse is going to be Esav, Lavan, and Yosef. In other words, yeah, you're right. You're going to have a problem as a result of this.
I never heard that.
Oh, okay. So there are all sorts of different layers to it, including, yes, the idea of Nevuah. This, in general, in terms of understanding what Rivka did there, there are different approaches in the Mefarshim, but one approach is that she's acting with Nevuah throughout. That's how she knows that this is what's supposed to happen, and that she's saying, look, this is the way it's supposed to be. I have a Nevuah that you will not get hurt from this. If anything will happen, it'll be for me.
Do we ever see anything happen to her? Does she ever get punished?
No. Not that we know of. We don't know a whole lot about Rivka after this story. Right? We even have this veiled death, right? It's not even very clear. It's Devorah's death, but we say it was Rivka's death. In Parshas Vayishlach. But that's your first set of problematic behaviors in regarding Esav, and as I put it, Esav 1, because there's going to be Esav 2 coming in a little bit. But after Esav, then of course he runs away. He goes to the house of Lavan, and in the house of Lavan he ends up marrying first Leah and then Rachel and Bilhah and Zilpah as well. But before all the marriages, Yaakov meets Rachel at the well, right? Because that's where you go back in the day. So if you take a look at source number 2, look at what Yaakov says. Yeah, no, that was where you went.
The pizza
shop. There's a Shabbos, and they didn't want to open the pizza shop, so he went to the well. Vayagei Yaakov leRachel, ki achi avihahu. Yaakov told Rachel that he was her father's brother, v'chi ven Rivkahu, and that he was Rivka's son. Vataratz vatagei leAviha, and she ran and told her father. What bothers you in that sentence? There's something wrong in that sentence.
Her father already.
Right, first of all, he's not her father's brother, right? Her father is? No, Rachel's father.
Lavan.
Her father is Lavan. Right? Unless somehow or other something very strange happened, he's not her father's brother.
Isn't Ach like a relative?
Yeah, my cousin.
So, Ach can be relative, and also father can be grandfather. Right? We sandwich generations all the time, especially in Bereishis, but in general in Chumash, they do that. In fact, the relationship between Yaakov and Rachel, right, is Rachel is the son of Lavan. Lavan is Rivka's brother, right? Lavan is Rivka's brother, and he is, I feel like when I'm trying to figure out all my second cousins and whatever, I can't do it. So I get so confused in Toronto. I don't understand. I just know everyone's related to everybody else, but no matter how many times they explain it, I don't know why. But Lavan...
Even the ones who are related don't really know.
Okay, that makes me feel better. So Lavan is Yaakov's uncle. Right, that's really the bottom line. Achi Aviahu, he's actually not. He is the nephew of Lavan. Right, Lavan is his mother's brother. Right. That's the idea. So that's number one, is why does he say, I am his brother, if what he means is, I am his nephew? That's number... Yeah.
It seems like it's double. And then if he says that, why does Daniel say he's a Jew?
Exactly. And that's the other problem, is why did he add that he is the son of Rivka? Like, you, what are you telling me here? So take a look at the Medrash in Kala Rabsi, which is a very important Medrash for understanding all about Yaakov. Ve'aged Yaakov l'Rachel, ki achi avi ahu v'chi ben Rivkahu. Yaakov tells Rachel that he is, and so on. V'chi achi avi ahu, is he really the brother of her father? Alo ben achos avi ahu. There you go. He's the nephew. Ella kevan da'amar la ben Rivkahu. The problem is that he wants to tell her that he's Rivka's son. Amar la minsibisli. He says to her, marry me, I'm from the family, and so on. Amar la yihain nasuba minsibalach. She says, I'm willing to. Ela abba rama'ahu. But you know, my father is a trickster. He plays games. Lo yachlasli. You can't win. You're not going to beat him. Which, in fact, was true. Because he's not. But Yaakov responds, Amar la achiv ana beramausa. I am his, that's a mistake in my translation, brother. I am his brother in deception. He thinks he's going to deceive me.
He said, I'm worse.
Right. Or at least I'm his match. Right. And this is found, right, and this is found in Bereishis Rabbah. Also, there's another version of it. Rashi, I think, on the Pasuk also brings elements of this. I think the way Rashi frames it on the Pasuk is to say, it all depends how Lavan's going to treat me. If he's going to be honest with me, I'll be Ben Rivka. On the other hand, if he's going to play games, I'm his brother. I can deal with him on that level also. And this is a very important point that we're going to have to come back to. But right now, what we see is Yaakov enters Laban's house with a sense of, I may need to do this again. What I did to Esav, I may need to pull that out again, this time to deal with Laban. And in fact, he does. We know, of course, he gets tricked regarding his wives, but when it comes time for him to be paid, right, at the end of, after they have all the kids, and it's time for him to get paid, so Laban says to him, all right, here's the deal, and everyone gets very confused by all this business with the swapping of the animals and what was supposed to happen, but he is only supposed to have the animals that are produced with certain markings on them. They separate out all the animals that have those markings, and so he's not going to be able to just breed them to produce, and yet he ends up getting animals that produce the young that look the way that they're supposed to look in order to be his. He's going to get the animals with the markings, and those are the ones that are produced. And how does he accomplish that end? The second pasuk in number 2. Vayatzeges hamaklos asher pitzel bar hatim b'shikasos hamayim. He takes sticks. He removes the bark in various patterns, and he puts them in the troughs where they're going to get their water, where the animals will get their water. And whenever the animals come to drink, they see these sticks, and that affects somehow what they produce. How that works, the animals see it, and therefore they want to mate with animals that look like that, or whatever the method is. It's not Mendelian genetics, but something else is going on. He explains it to Rachel and Leah. He says, a Malach told me this is what you do, and it all worked out. But what he's doing is effectively playing games with Laban. Right? This wasn't what Laban had in mind. What Laban had in mind was, you're going to get whatever animals are born with these markings, and it's unlikely they will be born with those markings, so therefore you're not going to get much. And Yaakov, through this manipulation, guided by a Malach, says, I'm going to make things work for me. And he does. He gets everything that Laban thought he was going to get. Yaakov walks away with all the wealth. But it's fundamentally a trick. This wasn't what was supposed to happen. He's manipulating in order to get what he wants. And then finally, when they run away, I wouldn't have seen running away as a deception. I mean, it is a deception. He ran away.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah, that too. Sometimes you want to just drive through the night, and then you get there. So it's true. I wouldn't have thought of it that way, though, just because he's fleeing. He's trying to escape with his life. But look at the word that the Pasuk uses, the third line, number 2. Vayignov Yaakov as Lev Lavan Ha'arami. It doesn't use that word by chance. Right? He stole the heart of Laban, Abli Gilo Kivoreahu, not telling him that he was running away. When the Torah uses the word Vayignov, it wants you to read it as theft. Otherwise it wouldn't use that word. There's something here in the way that he deals with Laban. Sorry?
Getting paid back for stealing the bracha.
Well, Laban had nothing to do with the bracha.
No, No, but I'm saying the word fake note.
Oh, you mean now we're marking him as a thief because after all he had done that? Maybe. I think
so
it has to do with
punished for that. Yeah, so why are you hanging that for them?
Right.
It's not like derogatory. Like it's not.
That's true.
She's trying to find this whole episode is like they knew where Ratz and Hashem was, and he didn't mean to take the brothels was.
Right. It was for a purpose. It was for like Nebuah.
You can, but that only pushes the question one step further, right? Why is this Ratzon Hashem? Why does Hashem want Yaakov to have to accomplish everything in this ridiculously backhanded way? If Hashem wants Yaakov to end up with wealth, let him do it the way he did it with Abraham. Right? Why does he need to get wealth? Or the way he did it with Yitzchak, better than Abraham, right? Abraham gets it from power. That's not a great example. But Yitzchak gets wealth because he plants the field and it grows 100-fold. Like, that's a nice way to get wealth, as opposed to a father-in-law who's trying to cheat you of your salary, and now you have to play games in order to get it from him. If you want him to have a bracha... But it's not. Not everybody has this. Yitzchak doesn't have this. Why does Yaakov?
The whole bechorah thing is only for wealth. There's no, like, deeper... Like, what would happen...
Bechorah or bracha?
Yeah, it's the first time I ever heard it separated. I'm like,
oh, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, two different things. So the bechorah is definitely wealth. The bechorah is the double share.
They deal out of this wealth. Like, why?
What would happen to us if Yaakov hadn't got whatever?
Right. If he wasn't a wealthy man,
would it still be us or not?
He wouldn't have had 12 children.
So he wouldn't have been able to send him to yeshiva. Shane Baber had a dorm. That was very expensive.
He's a poor man.
Right, so how you define Pishnayim when it comes to the transfer of everything to Yaakov is really unclear. This is true. But the identity of being, so to speak, the executor, the one who's going to have control over everything that happens thereafter, and more, the bracha, in which he says to him, Mital Hashemayim, Mishmanei Haaretz, Yavducha Amim, right? It's not just about wealth. It's conveying essentially what Rivka was told, right? That one nation is going to serve the other, Rav Yavod Seir. That's what's being conveyed. Yavducha Amim, Yishtachavu Lecha Le'umim, all the nations are going to serve you.
But you just said that it's two separate things, the bracha and the bechorah.
Right, the bechorah is just wealth. The bracha is superiority in general.
The bracha makes sense, but the bechorah,
we don't see the bracha, no one's serving us. I mean, we don't need them to, but...
Right, so maybe this is what was supposed to happen because in the days of David and Shlomo, that was where things were headed before they went south and you split into Yehuda and Yisrael. But it could be that this is what we were supposed to grow into. That would be the idea. In other words, we were supposed to be the nation that would present Torah to the world. Those who want to join and observe the Torah have it. Those who don't want to join and observe Torah end up being secondary to this nation that descends from Yaakov.
But it seems that the bracha had more of a significance than the bechorah because Esav willingly...
Yes, the bracha is a much bigger deal.
He was screaming, he was begging for another bracha. You don't have any more? Think of something else.
Right. No, the bracha is a much bigger deal than the bechorah. Not to mention, as various mafarshim ask, it's an all or nothing with the bracha. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, when Esav finds out that the bracha has been given to Yaakov, he says, you got nothing left? Right? I mean, that's what he says. Habracha achas. Right? You only had one bracha, Dad? And that's what he says to him.
What was he going to give Yaakov?
Right, and that's the question.
He was going to give Yaakov nothing, and he sees like he's...
And that's the answer. He was going to give him nothing. That's exactly right.
Because he knows Hashem is going to take care of him because he's so pure.
So that's the Shem Mishmuel's idea. The Shem Mishmuel says what Diana just said, that he felt Esav needs the bracha, and Yaakov doesn't need it. Which is a nice read. I have to admit, I have a lot of trouble seeing that in the Pesukim, but he's the Shem Mishmuel, and I'm not, so...
And then they could have been like two equals. Maybe they could have both been good then.
Yeah. Wasn't it also that Esav
he's been good,
it was so like against his nature that he's been able to overcome that struggle within him, and he would have been good, he would have been better than Yaakov even, because he would have accomplished like something that was given to him that he naturally had more of a Yitzhak Hara or something, that maybe Yitzhak thought that he really could get there, and then Yitzchak realized that he wasn't. Like, he wasn't a good person. Like, Yitzchak knew that he was a murderer. Yitzchak wasn't...
I mean, we can go around and around on this, and the answer is always going to be the same, which is the Psukim tell one story and the Mefarshim see another. That's really what it all boils down to. And yeah, far be it from me to know which one is what we're meant to learn from, but I suspect it's both. What you have is Yaakov first dealing with Esav in this very odd way, and then dealing with Lavan in this very odd way, and then you get Esav a second time. Right? Yaakov comes back to Israel, and often people miss just how strange Yaakov's conduct is when he comes back, because we're all caught up in like fighting an angel and you know, why not? But Yaakov made a decision when he came back. If you were Yaakov and you were leaving Laban's household to come back to the land of Canaan to go see your father again, right? What would be your strategy as far as Esav is concerned? What would you expect to do?
Have some encounter, conversation.
Why?
Lay low.
Because you ran away from him last time.
Lay low is what I would do. Esav is living, remember, the Torah tells us where Esav is living. Esav is living in Seir, in Edom, way down south.
I mean, you don't have to.
Yitzchak's in Hebron. You don't need to ever know Esav.
He'll come in quietly.
He sends messengers looking for Esav.
Why
did he think this was a good idea that he goes looking for Esav? The answer is he has something he wants to accomplish. This isn't a chance encounter, nor is it Esav's been tracking him, waiting and waiting and waiting for 20 years, and now he's there with 400 men. Yaakov went looking for Esav, not the other way around.
So that whole song, Esav was coming with 400.
Yeah, it's a great song though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I liked it. He goes looking for Esav. Right, this is true. He did have 400 men. Take a look at source number 4. Look what Yaakov does with this gift that he sends Esav. And we know this. We see it when Rashi makes the point of showing it to us on the Parsha. But I don't know if we always think about what he was doing. He gives flocks to his servants to send to Esav. And he says to his servants, Ivru lefanai, you go in front of me. Verevach tasimu bein eder uvein eder. Put a gap between each flock. What does Rashi say is the reason why you're putting a gap between each one? To make it look bigger. This is what we call deception, right? I mean, that's what he's doing. And again, like you learn it as a kid, and you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But no, that doesn't make sense. That's lying. Like, why is this a good thing? And then, of course, the more famous part of it.
Well, why is that a bad thing? He's trying to deceive Esav. He knows Esav is in Russia.
Right, he's trying to deceive Esav.
More deception.
It's just more deception from Yaakov.
A good deception.
In what sense?
I mean, it's good for all of us here that he did that.
Okay.
Yeah, but is there good deception?
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't the Torah
trying to
say that honesty is not always the best policy?
I agree with that.
Hadassah, you just got the answer to your question.
I did?
Yes. Chayla just gave you the answer. The answer to the question of how do I teach this to my children is, this teaches us that honesty is not always the best policy.
You can't teach that to your kids.
Your friends asked you, how do I look? How do I look? Amazing. You've done
right.
X, Y, and Z. And
she will tell you how you are.
Okay, so we're going to have to see this in greater depth. There's more to see. There's more to see here. There's a lot to see on this.
Also, Yaakov himself is known as Emes. Like, he is the...
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Obviously, there's something...
Correct. There has to be something more to this. Take a look at number 4, the second line. I brought you only one pasuk out of a much larger section. This is the way Yaakov talks to Esav. Vayomer, Esav says, Milacha kol hamachana azeh asher pagashti. What is all this? The word me does not mean who. The word me is a question word in general, which often is the question who, but not necessarily. He says, what is all this? This whole camp that you've got that I encountered? What's the whole gift? Vayomer, and Yaakov responds, Limtzochein, to find favor, Be'enei Adoni, in the eyes of my master. He calls Esav my master 8 times. And as the Medrash notes, at the end of the parsha, at the end of Vayishlach, the end of Vayishlach, we find that that Esav has eight kings from Edom, and the Torah stresses before there is a king for the Jews. Lifnei Melech Melech Lifnei Yisrael, says the Medrash, because you called Esav my master eight times, they get to have eight kings before you even have one. So in other words, he's punished for having done this. This is a bad thing, this kind of obsequious approach. There's a lot to be said about
flattery. It's a flattery. Really?
Not like it is.
At one point
he even says, he says, seeing you is like seeing the face of God.
Well, it's part of the deception. He's trying to like lure him in, make him think we're friends, and then...
Yeah.
So why is he so adamant that he brings him all these gifts? Like, why? What does he care so much?
Well, because he doesn't want to get killed. He thinks that this is a good idea. But there's more to this. There's more to this whole story. I'm getting there.
Right.
I'm building up the problem first.
Now, like, he's bringing it on. He saw him when he searched for Esau, and deceiving him.
One more piece to this, and that's the war with Shechem. Who tricked Shechem? But you know the story, right? They kidnap Dina, right? And they're holding Dina, and they say, "Well, just marry us, and everything will be good." Shimon and Levi? What did Shimon and Levi do? They tricked them. They told them, right? Right. And what's Yaakov's response?
He got upset.
Yaakov gets very angry after the war, right? What's Yaakov's response before the war? Sadasi says, does he know about it? Take a look. Take a look at source number 5.
He was fine with that, I think.
Take a look at source number 5. Remember how the conversation between Shimon Levi and Shechem took place. Vayetze Chamor Avi Shechem El Yaakov L'daber Ito. Chamor, father of Shechem, went to Yaakov to talk to him about this. And Shimon and Levi jumped in with their offer. But Yaakov is there. Yaakov knew exactly what they were going to do.
Well, they grew up.
They answered that before. That was a part of the thing before Yaakov got to respond.
Chamor is going over to say what?
To say, we really like Dina, and we would like to have you guys live among us, and marry among us, and so on.
And
Shimon and Levi say, sure, absolutely, just do the bris milah first. That's the deal. He's there.
Yaakov was in their plan.
Yaakov knows full well what's going on. That's why, I think it's why, Rashim Shin Rafal Hirsch argues that Yaakov's response after the war, when he's all horrified, is not about the plan of making them vulnerable and getting to punish them for what they did with Dina. It's for what happened next, taking the spoils.
Right.
He says, they had no business taking spoils. If this is really just punish them for wrongdoing, then punish them for wrongdoing and go away. You don't steal their property. That's the that's where Yaakov says enough. But the but Yaakov knows the plan against Shechem.
Yeah.
That's the way it looks in the Chumash.
There was no chance of if you all have a bris, then it's okay and we'll like we'll marry. No.
I don't think so.
No. So it's from the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's the plan.
It was premeditated.
Yeah, it would be interesting to suggest.
Entire city.
Because either because they did not stop what had happened, they did not free Yaakov's daughter, or alternatively because they didn't set up dinim, they didn't set up courts, as Ramban talks about there. There are mitzvahs b'nei Noach, and they're responsible for them. But yeah, as Adina noted, take a look at number 6. This is the classic source for the idea that you've heard. Titein emes liyaakov, chesed liabraham. Right? Emes is associated with Yaakov.
Yeah, that's
just yeah. So what is this?
And perfection.
And Barris,
he was perfect.
Yeah. How do we understand this at all? Now, mind you, the people who Yaakov is dealing with are not wonderful people, as was noted. Right? It's not as though you can make Esav, Lavan, and Shechem into these innocent, vulnerable victims who we should have any pity for. Right? Esav is introduced to us from the very beginning as Yaakov's opposite. And Yaakov is introduced to us in the very beginning as Ish Tam, somebody who is complete. So Esav, whatever he is not Tam. He has never been Tam, and he will not be. He is uncouth. He comes into his father with the food. He says, Yakuma vi viochal. My father should get up and eat. Right? And he's not, with all his respect for his father, this is not a polite person. How etain enough? Feed me from this red stuff because I'm really tired. He does sell his bechora for a bowl of soup, and vayivez Esav is ha-bechora. He degrades it. He doesn't consider it to have any significance. He marries Chiti wives. Right, the Chiti wives who Abraham told Eliezer, I don't want my son marrying a woman from Canaan, that's who Esav marries, and indeed at the end of the parsha, when he sees that Yitzchak doesn't like it, and I'm sorry, before that, the Torah tells us that his wives are Moras Ruach, Yitzchak and Rivka. They make Yitzchak and Rivka upset. They're terrible for them. And then he sees it and he says, okay, fine, I'm going to go marry from Yishmael's family. But this is, you know, Esav is through and through the opposite of Yaakov. And then, of course, he says, I'm going to kill my brother. Let's not forget that. He does bring the 400 men to meet him, and it's not a surprise party. And then you see it in his descendants. Remember that the Torah likes to carry traits across families. Right? It identifies certain traits with certain clans. So there are traits that we associate with Bnei Yisrael, for example. When you look at Esau's descendants, his grandson Amalek, the nation of Edom, who end up being a nation that gives us a great deal of trouble in Tanakh. So it all fits this picture of who Esau is. Like, don't come out of this thinking that we're defending Esau. We're not. But we need to understand Yaakov. Yeah.
So he doesn't even sound like such amazing Kibbutz Av Em. And isn't that we use him almost like a symbol of amazing Kibbutz Av Em?
Well, he sees that his wives are not good for his father, and he goes off and marries other women.
But going to get him and come eat the food? Like,
yeah, that really is... he's uncouth. Mm-hmm. He needs some manners. This is true.
That's so
Kibbutz. Okay. So what I think this is really all about is that Medrash and Kala Rabsi in number 3. When he says to Rachel that he can be a deceiver also. Yaakov wears the mask of whoever he's dealing with. So in other words, and that's why I didn't want to just talk about deception. What is Esav's attribute? What do we know about Esav? What does he excel at?
Hunting.
He's a trapper. Right, that's exactly. He's a tzayid. He's a trapper, hunter. And so when he deals with Esav, it's always a trap from the beginning. Sorry.
Ki tzayid
b'fiv. Exactly. But he traps Esav both times. Esav number one and Esav number two. He's going to deal with Laban. He'll be a deceiver.
Whoever he's dealing with, he has to be deals with them.
He takes on whatever it is that they have. Shechem is a population that is violent. They're the ones who exhibited this already regarding Dinah. So he is going to use violence against Shechem. The problem is this really a role model? So is that a good thing? So to make the point sharper, and this goes back to the point that Chayla was making before, we do this also. Halachically, there are masks that a person is supposed to wear for particular purposes. So one example of that is source number 7, the Gemara in Yevamos. And that's the one that was just mentioned. The person asks you, how do they look? So Amar Rabbi Yilah, Mishum Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, Mutar lo la'adam l'shanos bedvar ha-shalom. Rabbi Yilah says, quoting Rabbi Elazar, you are allowed to change the truth in order to achieve peace. And he quotes what the Shvatim did, right? Yosef's brothers. After Yaakov dies, they say, our father said, tell Yosef, you should not bear a grudge against your brothers for what they did. There's no such conversation, at least as far as the Chumash is concerned, and therefore as far as the Gemara is concerned. There was no such conversation, but they're trying to pursue peace. You find the same thing with Shmuel at one point, that he does the same thing. He lies to Shaul in order to save himself from harm. So the idea of preserving peace, by the way, it's a complete side note, but it's a worthwhile side note. Yaakov knows or does not know that the brothers sold Yosef. In the beginning, he doesn't know. That's very clear. He's unaware. But after Yosef is identified for him, and after he comes down to Egypt, does Yaakov ever learn how Yosef got there?
I think he
does. He doesn't sound like the sort of thing you want to tell him. Even if it did all turn out okay in the end. It's not like you really want to tell him that, you know, he spent 20-something years mourning for his son who had been sold by his brothers. The reason I ask is just because the brothers take it as a given that Yaakov knows. Right? And in the brachos, it sounds like Yaakov knows. He says, in the bracha for Yehuda, Miteref b'ni Alisa, which you can read as from tearing up, from prey, P-R-E-Y, my son, you arose, or you can read it as Miteref b'ni, from the tearing up of my son, you rose. Because Yehuda is the one who's held responsible for the sale of Yosef. There are different ways you can read it, but it does sound like Yaakov at some point finds out what had happened. That's a side note. You have the idea of altering truth for the sake of essentially maintaining positive social relations. You have a Mishnah in Shviyas, source number 8, which talks about where you have a friend who is not careful about Shemitah and is going to process Shemitah produce inappropriately. So look what the Mishnah says. Mash'elas isha l'chavrta ha'chashuda ala shviyas nafa u'kvara v'rechaim v'tanur. You're allowed to lend all this different equipment to your friend who is suspected of violating Shemitah. The only thing you're not allowed to do is violate Shemitah with her. Lo tavur v'lo titchanima. You're not allowed to get involved in the activity yourself. Shein machzik mechazkin yidei ovrei avera. You're not supposed to strengthen the hands of people who are sinning, but you are allowed to enable them. Why? Darkei shalom, in order to preserve peace. So you don't go around and tell them, I disapprove of what you're doing.
That's creepy. Yeah. I'm giving my friend a car on Shabbos.
You should give it to them before Shabbos. Yes. And there's a whole host of questions left. Na'iv rochea, tochiach, and so on. If this were halachashir, we would have a whole discussion about this. It always depends on the circumstances. But the point is, not saying the things that you're really thinking in order to preserve shalom. And this is baseline halacha. This is not news, this Mishnah. The source number 9 talks about you're dealing with non-Jews and not highlighting the differences, but instead pursuing darchei shalom. This is one type of mask that people wear. Another one is the mask of a parent. Take a look at source number 10, please.
Wait, does that mean we bury the same non-Jews all the
time? It doesn't mean in the same physical space. It means that when we are burying ours, we also take care of burying theirs. That's the idea. Yeah, it doesn't mean in the same space. Yeah, I know. This is a classic question, but that's the answer. Source number 10. Hakas mida ra'hi abla ma'od. The Rambam writes, anger is, sorry about the placement of the staple, I asked someone to staple it for me and they did a fine job. Hakas mida ra'hi abla ma'od. Anger is a very bad trait. V'ra'oi la'adam she'yisrachek mimena ad hakatzeh ha'acher. The Rambam says a person should stay to the extreme away from it. V'ilameid atzmo shalo yichos v'afilo al-dabar she'ra'oi lichos alav. One should teach himself not to get angry even when it's something that's worthy of anger. What if somebody wishes to make people afraid? His family, his household, the community. In my Aparnas, assuming he's a leader. So what should he do? He wants to display anger such that they will then follow proper behavior. He should pretend to be angry in order to get them to do what they're supposed to do. Fatia datum yushevas benolo benatzmo, but inside he should be calm. You pretend to be angry, but outside, only on the outside. So the kid, you know, runs across the street or whatever it is, you have to display anger. They have to understand that this is not acceptable. So you display it, but you don't feel it.
That you are angry.
But well, that's a side note. This is the Rambam talk.
But you're really calm, but you're also putting on a show of anger.
You're putting on a show of being calm while you're, yeah, whatever.
While
you're putting on a show of anger. Layer upon layer. Human beings are complicated. But this idea, for which there are other elements as well, I brought you number 11, the idea that you leave things for your children to achieve. You don't solve the problems for them. Sometimes you pretend that you don't have a solution in order that they should grow and develop independence. So, as a parent, there are masks that you wear with your child. Sometimes there are masks that we wear because it's halachically mandatory under the guise of tzniut. And I don't mean now physical dress. I'm talking about the broader concept of it. If you take a look at source number 12, Ma Hashem Doresh Mimcha, Micha asks, what is it that Hashem wants from you? Kim Asos Mishpat. He says, practice justice, avas chesed, to love kindness, vatznei alechazim alokecha, and to walk privately with your God. Your relationship with Hashem is meant to be for you personally. It's not meant to be discussed and described for the entire world. This really is its own shiur and needs greater discussion. But but I'm bringing it here only to show that we're being encouraged to hide things. The Gemara Bava Metzia in source number 13 says that Bahani Tlasmili Avide Rabbanan de Mishana Bemilayu. Torah scholars are likely to, and my translation is not precise. I wrote may lie, but it says Avidi de Rabbanan. This is normal for the Rabbanan to change their words in three things. And the first one is Mesechta. When it comes to somebody asking, do you know such and such a tractate? Not when they're asking a question, like I have a question about Kiddushin Daf Mem, but they're just asking, have you learned that? Say no. Better to say, I don't know it.
It's not clear.
Right. Well, no, right, that's true. I should read that the other way. Yeah, no, it's not. It means to conceal that you know it. It doesn't mean to pretend that you know it. Yeah. But this is all fundamentally about deception, even though, as source number 14 says, Chosamo Shalakadosh Baruch Hu Emes, Hashem's seal is truth. So now what we've seen... What we've seen here is that, number one, Yaakov is a person of masks, depending on whom he's dealing with, and we are people of masks, and indeed Halacha tells us to be people of masks. So what do you make of that? So because we got started late, I'm going to actually give an answer instead of doing the whole discussion of it. There are different kinds of masks. And I'm going to start with two, although there's a third that I want to talk about also. The first kind of mask is the mask that fools somebody else. The second kind of a mask is the mask that fools yourself. And they're different. They have different risks. They have different justifications. There are justifications for the first kind of mask. In other words, we ask, we're supposed to be honest, but not always. There are times when it's justified, whether it's darchei shalom, whether it's parenting, whether it's tzniu, whatever it is, there are justifications for the mask that tricks others, and Hashem does it also. Right? The whole concept of hester panim. Literally, hester panim, hiding his face, right? Because this is what is appropriate for us at that point. Or, to bring the pasuk I brought you in number 15, im chasid tis chasad, im gibor tamim ti tamam, im navar ti tavar, im ikesh ti tapol. This is David HaMelech praising Hashem. And he says, Hashem handles people according to their behavior. If someone is chasid, Hashem will act with chasidut towards him. If a person is tamim, Hashem will be tam with him. But if someone is nikesh, if someone is stubborn and difficult, so Hashem will treat him that way also. Hashem will do just as Yaakov did. He addresses people in accord with who they are. And that's what Yaakov does. He follows Rivka's instructions when it comes to dealing with Esav the first time. Self-preservation with Laban is a justification. Self-preservation with Esav the second time. He feels it's better if he takes the initiative as opposed to wait for Esav to eventually come after him. And protecting Dina when it comes to Shechem. But there's a risk. And the risk is the second mask. The risk is you fall into the mask that fools yourself. The Gemara Megillah talks about, I know Hanukkah is coming, but this is Purim. It talks about Purim and what leads to the downfall of the Jews. Why is it that we are vulnerable to Haman? Anyone remember the Gemara's answer? What was it that led God to say they should be victims of Haman? Right. They went to Achashverosh's Seuda. They went to the meal of Achashverosh, where they had kosher food. That wasn't the problem. But the problem was they acted as though they were supporters of Ahasuerus. And the response is, but we did it for show. We don't really embrace Ahasuerus. And so the Gemara says in number 16, Amar Lahem, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says to his students, Heim lo asu el lefanim. They did it just for show. Avakadosh Baruch Hu lo asay mahen elefanim. So God put on a show also. Made it seem like they were going to get destroyed. You want to do that? Fine. Because when you participate at the Su'ud of Achashverosh, you deceive yourself into thinking that this is okay, into thinking that you can become a Persian also. That's the risk. And there's a grave price for self-deception. So on Monday, I was trying to think about what I was going to speak about for this year, and I decided I wanted to talk about this and the masks issue. So I had a shir at Shari Shemayim, so I had to drive all the way down, and then afterwards drive all the way back. And I said, all right, so let me see if there's a shir online about masks that, you know, maybe someone has something to say. Found a shir, it was interesting, wasn't about this. But he did quote a passage from Kierkegaard that I really liked and that fit this very well, and that's what you have here as number 17. For anyone who's not familiar, Kierkegaard is a Danish philosopher. Lived in the 19th century. Rav Soloveitchik loved to quote him on the Akeda. It is the all-time best work written in English on the Akeda is Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling.
He's not Jewish.
Not Jewish.
Okay.
Not Jewish.
Why have I heard of that Fear and Trembling? Is there another?
Because he gets quoted a lot, because it's really, really good.
You also mentioned that, I believe.
Did I mention it here?
Like, yeah,
could be. Every year, when I was in the Shul Rabbinate, every year before Rosh Hashanah, when I wanted to figure out what I would talk about, so I would pull out Fear and Trembling and say, I'm going to talk about Fear and Trembling in the Akeda. And Karen would just look at me and say, no, you're not. But, yeah, you can pretend that you're going to, because it's unbelievably great. It doesn't work as drasha material. But it's really, really, really good. But anyway. He also wrote something called Either Or. This is actually his first published work. And the idea of either or, in a nutshell, is there are two ways you can say either or. Either or can be like whatever. Someone asks you, should I do this? Or you have an opportunity. You can choose to do this or not do it. No, could go this way, could go that way. Doesn't make a difference. Or you can look at these as decision words. Like, I am at a moment when I could go this way or I could go that way. It's a moment that has meaning and has significance. Either this or that, and you weigh your decision as something of significance. So what Kierkegaard is writing about in context here is he's talking to somebody who just says, whatever, doesn't matter, whatever you do, you do, and is trying to explain to him how bad that is. That you don't take things seriously, you don't take your choices seriously. And look what he says to him. And now, as for you, this phrase, either or, is only too often on your lips. It has almost become a byword with you. What significance has it for you? None at all. You, according to your own expression, regard it as a wink of the eye. You take great delight in, quote, comforting people when they have recourse to you in critical situations. You listen to their exposition of the case and then say, yeah, I perceive perfectly there are two possibilities. One can either do this or that. My sincere opinion, my friendly counsel is as follows. Do it or don't do it. You'll regret both. But he who mocks others mocks himself. And your rejoinder is not a mere nothing, but a profound mockery of yourself. A sorry proof how limp your soul is. That your whole philosophy of life is concentrated in one single proposition. I say merely either or. In case this really were your serious meaning, if you really meant, yeah, nothing matters, there would be nothing one could do with you. Now, on the contrary, since one knows very well that such is not the case, one is not tempted to pity you, but rather to wish that someday the circumstances of your life may tighten upon you the screws in its rack and compel you to come out with what really dwells in you, may begin the sharper inquisition of the rack which cannot be beguiled by nonsense and witticisms. Life is a masquerade, you explain. And for you, this is inexhaustible material for amusement. And so far, no one has succeeded in knowing you. You're wearing a mask by telling people, it doesn't matter, and not revealing what's really inside. You say, whatever, they don't really know me. I get to be Esav with Esav, and Lavan with Lavan, and Shem with Shem. For every revelation you make is always an illusion. Your occupation consists in preserving your hiding place, and that you succeed in doing. For your mask is the most enigmatic of all. In fact, you are nothing. An enigmatic figure on whose brow is inscribed either or. For this, you say, is my motto. And then you get to where he calls him on. He says, now, although nothing you say in that style has the slightest effect upon me, nevertheless, for your own sake, I will reply to you. Do you not know that there comes a midnight hour when everyone has to throw off his mask? Do you believe that life will always let itself be mocked? Do Do you think you can slip away a little before midnight in order to avoid this? Or are you not terrified by it? He's saying, at some point, you're going to have to figure out who you are. I have seen men in real life who so long deceived others that at last their true nature could not reveal itself. They pull off the mask and there's nothing underneath. I have seen men who played hide and seek so long that at last madness through them obtruded disgustingly upon others. Their secret thoughts, which hitherto they had proudly concealed, they get so frustrated with masking themselves that they can't mask any longer, and then they just, you know, write a blog and tell the whole world about every last thought they ever had. Or can you think of anything more frightful than that you thus would have lost the inmost and holiest thing of all in a man, the unifying power of personality? It's a great rebuke. But that's the warning. That's the problem. The mask that fools others in and of itself can be justified, but what happens when the mask is fooling yourself? Now what do you do when you've lost what's inside? And that's what Yaakov answers. This I really like. This made me think, oh, this is the shiur I want to give. Take a look at 18. This is what Yaakov does in between each occurrence of wearing a mask. He turns to Hashem each time. Take a look. Your first one is after his business was with Esav. He's running away. He took the stone. I see that we're at time, so I'm going to sum up what you see here. He makes a monument, puts oil on it, and he takes a neder to Hashem. Then, after his encounter with Lavan, he leaves the house of Lavan, and he turns to Hashem. Elokei Avi Avraham, Elokei Avi Yitzchak, right? I'm making a deal with you. He says, I don't deserve everything I've got. Save me now from Esav. But he has a conversation with Hashem. He leaves Esav, and then Vayatsiv Shem Mizbeach. He sets up a Mizbeach, Vayikra Elokei Elokei Yisrael. And then of course you have Shechem. And then after Shechem, Vayiben Shem Mizbeach, Vayikra Elokei Kel Beis Kel. He builds a Mizbeach, and again calls out in the name of Hashem. In other words, what Yaakov does is he follows up each deception by connecting with who he really is, which is still the Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim, who's connected to Hashem. He's never going to lose sight. It could be that he's justified dealing with Esav. I have to pretend to be Esav. But afterwards, I get to go back to being Ishtam, Yoshev Ohalim. I have to deal with love on this way? Fine. But afterwards, I'm going to go back to being Ishtam, Yoshev Ohalim. Each time, he refuses to let the mask define him. And interestingly, Yaakov produces a son who doesn't wear masks. Yosef. Yosef insists on not wearing a mask. He does it, you know, he has dreams. He could have been excused for hiding the dreams for Shalom. But no, he's going to tell his brothers about those dreams. Not only the first time, but the second time as well. Potiphar's wife comes after Yosef. He says, I can't. Chatasi lelokim. I will be sinning against God. The butler and the baker in the jail, he says, I am an Ivri. He identifies himself as a Hebrew. Paro names him. What name? Safnas Paneach, the one who sees that which is hidden. Yosef sees through the masks. And the one time he tries to put on a mask is when? With his brothers. And is that not the worst masquerade ever? Right? Half the time he spends running out of the room crying because he can't do it. He gives Shimon special treatment. Right? He gives Binyamin special treatment. He orders the brothers in the order of birth when he puts them out at the meal. He's like screaming, hi guys, hello, it's me. Yosef is, until finally he just, you know, drops the secret himself. But Yosef can't stand wearing the mask. It's the opposite of who he is. He's Yaakov's son. And Yaakov has to do it, but he fights against it each time. You follow?
Do you think that Yosef saw that and like almost
rebelled? I think Yosef is rebelling against the whole mask idea. I think so. There's one last piece that I brought you, which I'll just say outside in a couple of seconds. And that is, there's a third kind of mask. There's the one that deceives others. There's the one that deceives yourself. But there's also the natural one, which Rav Soloveitchik talked a lot about in The Lonely Man of Faith, and that's what I brought for you in 19 and 20, which is each human being is unique. Each human being has a unique soul and unique way of experiencing the world and a unique connection with Hashem. And no two people have the same one. And so there is a natural masking of the person when it comes to their relationship with others. No matter how close you are with somebody else, they will never know you the way Hashem knows you. They're never going to know what's truly in your neshama. They'll know what you're trying to tell them with the words that you succeed in finding, with the actions that you that you demonstrate. But ultimately, that's the idea of the lonely man of faith, is the idea that you are alone. And so that's a mask that one has to wear, that one doesn't have a choice about. And so the piece that I brought you here in 19 and 20 from Rav Soloveitchik, he talks about the solution, which is obviously to reach out to Hashem, but also to reach out to others in this state of being alone, in this state of having a mask, and you build a community of people who, recognizing that they have this, are at least able to exist together and relate in that regard and try to reach Hashem that way. I realize saying this in 1 minute doesn't do it justice, but you can read the Rav's quotes in 19 and 20, and that may help. Read The Lonely Man of Faith in general, and you'll be as confused as I am. But that's a third element of masks, which is worth discussing, I think, at some point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.